Chapter 9. Airborne. We were already lifting off in his private jet when Stewart admitted that he didn't have any masks. There were none in Los Angeles or Chicago, and he didn't have a line on masks at all, anywhere. He'd been up all night making calls, and he believed he had a new lead. He was acting on faith now, and armed with it, he intended to find another source and deliver 6 million masks to the VA by midnight. He enlisted the help of someone he erroneously said was the Attorney General of Alabama, his home state. I'd soon learn he was working through a cagey broker, who, in fact, was once the AG of Alabama, but was no longer. To get the deal done, he needed to get a bank to give him a loan against the VA's order. If he found masks, he'd still have to figure out how to get them to Hines, Illinois, ASAP. That was a lot to put on faith, I thought. I didn't yet know the half of it. The flight plan had also changed. En route to Chicago, we were stopping first in Columbus, Georgia, on the opposite end of the country, to pick up his parents, so they could come along on a charter jet to Chicago. I asked why he felt the need to fly more than 600 air miles to pick up his parents for a business meeting. He gave a long pause, took a breath, and said, "That Wall Street Journal article really affected my parents. He'd made me a liar. I told my editors that it would be just me, him, and a couple of employees. Now a couple of senior citizens were involved. I didn't have an N95, so in that moment I was mortified that I could get someone sick or worse." He broke down the perverse mechanics of a COVID-19 mask deal in this way. The VA awards a contract for goods at a set price per unit to federal government experts, aka Robert Stewart Jr. The federal government typically doesn't pay this up front. Instead, the hired gun gets a purchase order from the VA, a piece of paper, which proves the deal is backed by Uncle Sam. The contractor can then seek purchase order financing, where a bank or deep-pocketed private investor gives a high-interest loan to buy stuff. If the stuff is delivered, the feds pay up, and the company reaps a profit minus whatever it owes the bank or investor. Thus, for the company to make this work, the markup on the actual item must be substantial. The repayment terms on these high-risk deals are short, a few days or weeks. In return, the banks or private investors collect steep interest, as high as 20%, according to some brokers I'd soon meet. That's just the money. Because he wasn't a direct mask maker, he needed to find a legitimate supplier. To do so, he would need to go through a distributor or a broker. The big companies like 3M had already clamped down on distributors and were going after anyone trading on their brand. So he turned to the world of brokers. They'd collect a broker fee, usually a few cents or as much as a dime, per mask. Multiple brokers might be involved in any one deal, whether they help negotiate for the seller or the buyer or even between brokers. So in the end, a deal that would appear to the public to go like this: the VA pays $34.5 million to Robert Stewart, aka federal government experts, and the company delivers 6 million masks to VA. Actually, looks like this. The VA issues a purchase order to Federal Government Experts, LLC, and the company takes that purchase order to a lender and gets a high-interest, short-term loan, roughly equal to the cost to acquire masks. It's wired to the company's bank account. Stewart then coordinates with broker A, broker B, and broker C to locate a seller. Each broker has an agreement with Stewart to collect a finder's fee or commission. Once Stewart and the various brokers locate a seller, Stewart releases payment into an escrow account. Upon closing the deal, the funds are released, the seller is paid, and various brokers collect their fees. Then, masks in hand, Stewart delivers to the VA, which in turn wires a payment equal to the contracted rate. Stewart would then repay the loan to the lender, plus the agreed-upon interest due. This is not accounting for the cost of storage, cargo planes, freight forwarding, shipping insurance, and other ancillary costs that can add up quickly. The remainder, after all the overhead, the payouts, the interest, and the purchase itself, equals Stewart's profit. If this sounds stupid, that's because it is. As we approached our pit stop in Georgia, I had chicken scratched through an entire notepad while Stewart explained his business, his predicament, and the logic behind whatever it was we were doing. This was the second time that a shipment of masks was within his sight but evaporated. He claimed that, earlier in April, he had a line on N95 masks, sold by a distributor and allegedly made by a Chinese factory, Shanghai Dasheng. Everything looked good, he said, until the CDC put out a warning that loads of ineffective counterfeits bearing the name of this manufacturer and falsely labeled as NIOSH approved were flooding the market. Naturally, the VA didn't want those masks, so he was starting from scratch with only days left to deliver on his deal. Also concerning Stewart was news that the FBI and the Justice Department were beginning to round up mask brokers and counterfeiters and charge them for various nefarious schemes, including price gouging. Stewart's contracted rate of nearly $6 per mask was well beyond what some government consultants recommended. But that rate was what this crazy, unregulated free market was demanding, he said. I'm just trying to fulfill my obligation and not go to jail, he said. This was at least the fourth time Stewart had mentioned jail or prison without provocation. We don't want to do anything nefarious, he said. The goal here is not to get rich. The goal is to get crucial equipment to the government. With his deadline looming at 11:59 p.m. that night, Stewart said he still had faith that he could find 6 million masks and get them to the doorstep of the VA. The latest plan had come together just 12 hours before, when one of his contacts connected him with the former Attorney General of Alabama, a guy named Troy King, a Republican lawyer who held a variety of LLCs and side hustles, and whose name has often appeared adjacent to scandals in the newspaper. Further aiding his efforts was a mysterious woman to whom King had connected him, a Juanita Ramos, who allegedly had a relationship with someone on Vice President Mike Pence's White House coronavirus task force. This was the officially official one, not the Kushner kids assembled by the president's son-in-law. Now he had legitimate channels, Stewart said, and all the ingredients to pull off a miracle. Stewart held a tattered daily devotional Bible, plucked from his briefcase, as he explained how he would triumph in the face of adversity. As someone who had completed a proper Christian education and won several Bible Memory Award ribbons, long lost to movements of a rambling journalism career and doubt, I had an idea of where this was going. He flopped the book open and referenced Joshua chapter 24, verse 15, which in the New International Version ends with a familiar passage etched into many a Hobby Lobby tchotchke. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. He said this was a perfect analogy. But it was a bit lost on me. I might have picked Proverbs chapter 13, verse 16. All who are prudent act with knowledge, but fools expose their folly. After all, he said, it was a miracle that he'd gotten this important job in the first place. Awarding a $34.5 million contract to a small company without any supply chain experience, he mused. Why would you do that? He added, I've been reminded in this engagement that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Our tangent into the heavenly was cut short by our rapid descent to earth. At 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 25th, tail number N407FX skidded onto warm asphalt in Columbus, Georgia, with two men in the narrow and empty fuselage and two bemused pilots in the cockpit. As Stewart dropped through the plane door, I stopped in the tiny bathroom and stared in the mirror for a long second. Wild as this assignment felt, I noted that I myself looked a tad unhinged. I hadn't been able to get a haircut before the lockdowns, and my hair was already on the longer side. Now my shag and beard tufted out at the seams of my mask, as if Teen Wolf had grown up and become a surgeon. I took a couple of selfies for posterity. They're not great. I gave myself a silent pep talk. Part of me was worried that my more cautious editors were right. This might all be for naught, a dud. The scene before me had its elements of comedy, but I was heartsick with the knowledge of all the death and despair playing out in the hospitals, whose staff and patients were praying for capers such as this to be a success. Surely Stewart must have given some assurances to the government that he could get the job done, right? The government was desperate, and there was no meaningful oversight of how $17 billion in new emergency cash was going out the door, despite what the administration claimed. But I had to believe there was at least an inquiry as to his plan, his sources. My reporting is often guided by a solemn faith that people invariably do stupid and selfish things, and systems inevitably fail. Call it job security. But I never could have imagined recklessness of this magnitude. I was last to step out of the cabin and into the balmy Georgia air, where Stewart made calls from the asphalt and entered and exited the empty regional airport where his parents would soon arrive. Earlier that morning, Stewart had exuded the confidence of a world-class magician about to perform a career-defining trick. But now he showed obvious signs of stage fright. In between calls, Stewart chatted up the pilot. "Let me ask you," he said, admiring the contours and angles of a status symbol shimmering in the sun. "At what point does it make sense to buy a plane?" When his folks arrived, we greeted and boarded the jet as members of Stewart's extended family watched and said goodbye from behind a chain-link fence. "I paid for it," Stewart announced to the cabin. "Eat all the snacks." Narrator voice. He didn't pay for it. Also with us was Dawn Lockhart, Stewart's childhood friend and remote working human resources director. "This is the first time I've worn heels and a skirt in probably 3 years," Lockhart said. "Most days I work at home in my sweatpants." She, like me, had been told by Stewart that everyone on board would have access to an N95 mask. But there were none. So I sat about as far away from the other guests as I could, nearing the cockpit. Stewart's parents sat in the rear, his mother enjoying M&Ms, his father settling in for a nap. Despite his company's moniker, it appeared there was nothing expert about this operation. As we zipped skyward, Lockhart began to flip through a large college textbook labeled Strategic Staffing. Meanwhile, Stewart was poring over the weighty federal government tome, Federal Acquisition Regulation, or FAR, as those who've endured its contents call it. Stewart was building his company, like this deal, in mid-flight. That very day, if I hadn't been aboard that flight, I would have been watching the televised NFL draft. I thought of those amazing moments when you see an entire family lifted up by the unlikely payoff of a young man's hard work and ambition. Screams and shouting and crying. And often, that unmistakable sigh of deliverance. In a similar way, Stewart had been drafted by the federal government to the tune of $34.5 million. And he too wanted to share the glory with his family and literally lift them into his new world. Whatever his crimes, his belief that he could move up in a system stacked against him was precisely what we Americans preach. In this moment, for the sake of his family and the country, I wanted him to succeed. As Stewart said, "When you're a poor kid from Alabama, you do what you need to do to get the job done." Once again, it would not go down as Stewart had promised. He had said that once we landed at Chicago Midway International Airport, he would drop his folks off at the Hilton Oak Brook Hills Resort, and he and I would take a taxi over to the VA Distribution Center in Hines and wait for a mass delivery, even if we have to wait until 3 a.m. Instead, His entourage rented a few SUVs, and I took a separate Lyft ride to the hotel, where everything and nothing went down. After two very bored employees sitting behind plexiglass checked us in, we met in the vast lobby facing out into a rolling, empty golf course. The capaciousness of this convention center hotel was made larger still by its emptiness. The unlit and shuttered cafe, the pool with no people. It was only us in what could have been the Overlook Hotel, denuded of its history, charm, and spirits. Disturbing the eerie quiet was Stuart and his crew, who had formed an unofficial mission control from the lobby, where he worked two smartphones with increasing anxiety. He needed the VA to sign off on his new arrangement, but to win approval, he needed invoices and other documentation that he said Troy King, the former Attorney General of Alabama, hadn't yet provided. "Troy is not the first vendor," Stuart said. "Every time we go to a vendor and get ready to say, 'Give us 6 million masks,' they'd be gone by the time we got to the due diligence part of it, right? I finally got to a point after, like, the third time, when we got with Troy, I said, 'Hey, man, before we go through this deal, I need to see some proof of life.'" It sounded like something out of a hostage negotiation, but it was the standard parlance. Brokers would share a video showing that inventory, including some sort of timestamp to prove it existed, wasn't old footage, and was ready to be shipped. Just before 2 p.m., King had sent the proof of life. The grainy cell phone video pans over what appear to be hundreds of boxes labeled 3M. But it was unclear what was in the boxes or where they were housed. "Was that really how these mask deals were going down?" I thought. The video breathed new life into Stuart. He wanted to believe they were real, that he could get them, that the VA could get them, and all would be well. "Those are in Atlanta," King wrote beneath the grainy video. "They have 6.5 million, King continued. "Our cost is $4.90. King didn't explain who they were, but Stuart responded with gullible immediacy. "Okay, I'm good with that." Stuart had just agreed to pay $4.90 apiece for masks that should have cost about a dollar, which he would flip the very same day to the VA for about $5.90 apiece. A dollar was his cut, less the costs he would bear to get them to their final destination, and payouts to the various brokers in the chain and lawyers managing escrow. In other words, if he could get $29.4 million to the seller, he'd stand to make several million dollars. By 3 p.m., we were joined by an outside attorney, two consultants, and a friend of Stuart's from Houston, who made his living clearing debris after natural disasters such as Hurricane Harvey, the Category 4 storm that inflicted $125 billion in damage and killed more than 100 people. It was Roosevelt Trey Daniels III of Frontline Recovery who had connected Stuart to King, and, I'd later learn, at least two other politicians representing Texas and Louisiana. Emboldened by the video, Stuart and Daniels made dozens of calls in frantic succession to trucking companies, to supposed cargo jet owners. Daniels didn't want me around and tried to block his sound, but some slipped by. "Hey, Frank," Daniels said at one point into his cell phone, "who is a good freight company?" And that would lead to the next call and the next. "Well, I talked to Tess," Stuart said in another conversation. "Prefers 24-hour notice to get people in to unload the truck." "Well, when I talked to Daniel, it was 18 trucks," he continued, referring to what it would take to transport thousands of boxes carrying millions of masks. That, although individually light, amount to tons and tons of weight and volume. The next call. "Got a 727 that can get to Atlanta in 3 hours? Stuart got on the phone with King and walked out of earshot. When Stuart returned from his call with King, he said to me, "Troy still says he's putting his foot on the gas, man." As the clock ticked near 6 p.m., Daniels had suggested they send a portion of the shipment by truck to Illinois, while they figured out how to get the rest on planes. But Stewart insisted that he wanted to get the whole shipment there at once. "There's just a lot that's going to go wrong with multiple logistics companies involved," Stewart said. "I'd rather be late with all of it than on time with half of it and then the other half coming in damaged because it was in a hurry." I began to suspect that with each new call, each aside, and each curious huddle with Daniels and the other consultants, maybe Stewart was putting on a show. If the performance wasn't for my benefit, then perhaps it was for his compatriots or his parents. Also concerning Stewart was that his lender, whom he wouldn't disclose, was showing signs of backing out of the deal. They wanted clearer proof that the merchandise was real and that the VA backed the sale. Then a new idea emerged. Maybe they could buy some time by getting the VA to agree to an extension. Daniels had worked as a district director for the U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Houston area Democrat, and got her office to draft a letter in support of FGE on a deadline of just a couple of hours. I had covered politics off and on for more than a decade, including in Texas, and was astounded that these guys could sway a legislator to intercede in a contractual affair on such short notice. Even on the state level, that sort of help would require substantial lobbying influence and money. The letter read, "Mr. Stewart, a remarkable and heroic disabled veteran, used every resource available and took every step to ensure the United States Department of Veteran Affairs would receive their supply on time. Unfortunately, it has come to my attention that unforeseen circumstances may possibly cause an interruption in the scheduled delivery for the Department of Veteran Affairs. In the event that this delivery is off schedule, I am respectfully requesting your office to grant Mr. Stewart a 72-hour window pursuant to FAR 52.249-14. This explained why Stewart, who had spent years as a contract officer at the Pentagon, was reviewing the FAR on the plane. All day he had been looking for a way out. He had passed this provision to the Congresswoman's staff. Stewart also drafted his formal extension request, citing the same procurement code, and emails I'd later obtain would show King had coached him on what to say to the VA to keep the deal alive. As Stewart and I talked in the lobby of an empty hotel, VA contract officers were growing concerned that Stewart was full of it. One manager instructed a subordinate to go ahead and give Stewart an extension anyway, because it was easier to appease a member of Congress than deal with explaining why the VA terminated the deal, according to emails I'd later obtain. "We won't lose anything except a little time," the VA official said, "but at this point, that's all we really have." Stewart's parents popped in and out of the scene, looking worried for their son, but not altogether invested. Like dutiful but bored parents fulfilling their obligations at a Little League game. He sent the group to fetch some TGI Fridays takeout and got on the phone with the VA contracting officers overseeing his deal. His promises had turned to excuses. "Look, man, I don't drive trucks," he said into the phone. "Well, look, man, we're going to get the memorandum from Pence's team. We have the proof of life video. We have the attorney general calling over there. I don't know what else we can do." By Pence's team, Stewart meant the mysterious Juanita Ramos, who he hoped could draft a letter and pull strings in Washington with the vice president and VA secretary Robert Wilkie. While Stewart had heard this woman's voice on a previous phone call with King, he told me that he had no clue who she was. And by attorney general, Stewart meant King, who was no longer the attorney general of Alabama. In fact, King was now a private citizen, having just lost an election for one of that state's seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. The whole mess would take months to unravel to my near satisfaction, and much of what Stewart told me would prove false or impossible to confirm. What was clear is that the man who had so decried the nature of unscrupulous mask marauders had sailed into the storm and become captain of his very own sinking ship. As daylight slipped away, so too did any reasonable hope of this miracle working out. Stuart and Daniel's frenetic string of calls had succumbed to venting and finger-pointing. Between calls, I asked Stuart to share his communications with King, and he agreed. He also agreed to show everything he had submitted to the VA to get the deal in the first place. But when I asked if he would just go ahead and forward the records, using email and the hotel's free Wi-Fi so I could review them from my hotel room, he pointed at his MacBook and said he couldn't figure out how to access his files. This was from the CEO of an IT consulting company. Stuart's parents returned with dinner, and the group huddled around takeout appetizers in what Stuart joked was the Last Supper. His father patted him on the back. As they sat and ate in disappointment, I took up a section of floor. "I don't love defeat," he said to the crew, "but I do feel as though we've exhausted all resources." As I texted an update to my editor back in D.C. on what I'd just seen, Stuart transitioned into small talk about Netflix and TV shows, telling his colleagues, "That's actually one of my favorite shows, American Greed. I looked up that CNBC program on my phone. Its subtitle read, Some People Will Do Anything for Money. It's about con artists." The next morning, the dejected party boarded the return flight back to Dulles International by way of Columbus, Georgia. Just before liftoff, the pilot asked, "Anything I can get you before we take off?" "Yeah, 6 million N95 masks," Stuart quipped. An awkward hour and a half later, we landed in Georgia, where Stuart's parents and HR director deplaned. Stuart got out and snapped photos with his family in front of the jet, and reboarded the plane to endure an even more awkward hour alone with me. The CEO was in the same gray suit as the previous day, though it was now wrinkled, and his bold red tie had slacked. The trappings of a successful federal contractor tattering in real time. He said he'd been up all night. I had no reason to doubt him. With his friends and family now gone, his joviality had given way to exhaustion and the realization that the article I was about to write wasn't going to be fun for him. The optics of the private jet, he realized, would not be good. "The only reason I took the plane was because of my parents," he said. "They're old, and I didn't want to get them sick, and I wanted them to see this. I wanted to say thank you." Stuart said he had severed ties with King the previous night. The nail in the coffin on this deal, Stuart said, came late at night when Daniels knocked on his room and urged Stuart to just walk away. His friend convinced him something was off. Further fueling their suspicion, Stuart said he and his team couldn't track down any Juanita Ramos, the connection King purported to have to Pence's task force. I, too, had spent much of my evening trying to find this person, searching LinkedIn, all the social media, LexisNexis, and other expensive databases to which ProPublica subscribes to track down people, most of the time with success. Nothing turned up on the mystery woman who had serious White House connections. I absolutely do believe he made her up, Stuart suddenly disclosed. He's the one that made up this Figment Ramos lady. I didn't make that up. Narrator voice. She exists. So Troy King was saying he had an in with one of these distributors, yeah, and a stockpile of N95 masks, because he is a legal representative for one of these distributors, and that's acceptable, Stuart explained. Which distributor? I asked, sitting closer than was wise so I could hear his words through the clamor of wind ripping at our sides. I don't know who he represents, Stuart said. He wouldn't give me a name, and that's generally how these things work. Over the course of our conversations that day, Stuart had rambled about his dreams, his integrity, his mistakes. He revealed that he held ambitions to one day become the governor of Alabama. That was long term. In the short term, he aspired to go into business with a friend who had a large tract of land in Macon, Georgia. to build a factory for nitrile gloves, which were also in scarce supply and reliant on tangled supply chains stringing back to Asia. He planned to acquire a classic Oldsmobile 442, then paint it white with a royal blue racing stripe and white interior. He mused on and on, but it was my job now to bring him back to reality and make him aware of what this article would have to say. You know, I don't know if you're going to like the article as it is now, I told him. I really don't. I don't know exactly who did what, I said, according to one recorded conversation. I can only write about the facts in front of me, right? I didn't want to ask you in front of your mom, I continued. But I wanted to ask you about these conversations. Why is Troy King involved? He's taking a cut, you know, but what's the actual price of acquisition versus what's going to be charged to the VA? And it sounded like Trey Daniels had many of the same questions. I encouraged him to send me the communications and records. He would forward most of the materials, with the notable exception of the actual bid documents he'd provided to the VA, which would tell us how he'd represented himself and gotten this monster deal. Emails I'd later obtain would show he got the deal just by sending an email full of promises to a contract officer who said, "Let's see if he can actually come through with the product. Guy seems to be legit." As he and I drilled down, we got closer to the heart of my inquiry. Was all of this just a show? Did he take me, his friends, the VA, the American people for a ride? Were there ever any masks? Right now, you just think I'm full of shit, Stuart said to me. Because I haven't delivered. I didn't say that, I responded. He said his new plan was to come back to the VA with a much lower cost estimate. He had found a more reputable distributor, he claimed, and he could deliver just as many masks for half the cost. I told him that if that worked out, I would of course make it a prominent piece of the story. The story I should write, he offered, was one of a dedicated businessman paving his way to hell with good intentions. A caveat for hospitals and government bureaucrats seeking masks. It was he who had been taken for a ride. It took me a while, but I broke through the bullshit, he professed. I would rather be late and you go and you bash me in your article about me being late and being right, doing the right thing, than deliver something on time that has blood money on it. And it's going to get people hurt and I'm going to end up going to jail for it, right? Again, jail. After we landed in Washington, D.C., Stuart went on his way and I waited for a ride. I called my editor and attempted to explain what I'd just seen. I made a pitch I'd not made since I worked for an alternative news weekly where my angsty post-college drivel streamed down pages filled with advertisements for medical marijuana. It was a pitch I assumed would be met with eye rolls. We should write the story in first person. I thought just conveying what this world of mask brokering looks like and how odd it was to witness would be the best way forward. There were too many moving parts, ins and outs and what have yous, and too many unanswered questions to write it like a straight news article with demonstrative findings. And people needed this information faster than a full-fledged investigation would allow. She told me to give it a shot, and we agreed I'd take a couple of days to get what answers I could. When I reached out to Troy King, he ignored my calls, but had a spokesperson from his failed campaign shoot me an email. After several conversations over the weekend, Mr. Stuart informed us that he had secured these masks through another source, and that he would not need our services to secure the masks, King's spokesperson said. There have been no further conversations between Mr. Stuart and me. No agreement was ever made, no contract was ever executed, and no money was ever exchanged. King didn't respond to my inquiry about the mythical Juanita Ramos. I reached out to the Pence Task Force and the White House, but no one had ever heard of Juanita Ramos. I had no idea who she was. I couldn't find her, and I'd have to include that in the story. I reached out to the VA and recounted what I had witnessed, and the agency spokesperson informed me the next day that Stewart's contract had been canceled, and the case was being referred to the agency's inspector general. As we entered May, the agency was waiting, along with much of the federal government, on FEMA, the spokesperson said, while manufacturers like 3M were ramping up to produce hundreds of millions of masks under the Defense Production Act, some of which were destined for VA hospitals. The VA decided not to wait, so it hired contractors like Stewart to scour and scrounge for any domestic loot. The agency maintained that it did rigorous vetting of its contractors, which was bullshit, but we would publish their response nonetheless. In the end, VA hospitals, where at the time more than 2,200 employees had tested positive for the virus, ended up with zero additional N95 masks from its deal with Stewart. And as a result, the agency had paid nothing to Stewart. However, I would later learn that Stewart had been bankrolled by the government through a separate hustle. Just before publication, I did the routine follow-up with Stewart. He had not been informed that his contract was dead, which was unfortunate, so I delivered the news and asked if there was anything he'd like to add to the article. He said he just wanted people to know he gave it his best. "Stuff just never materializes," he said. "It's a bunch of smoke and mirrors and ghosts." After the article was published, Stewart ghosted on me, which wasn't unexpected. It would be nearly a year before we'd meet again in person, in federal court.